Kathy, Dan, Harry, John, thank you. Thank you very much. Winnie Guthrie wrote those words in the early weeks of 1948 after listening to the news on his radio. It will be another 10 years before someone else would set the words to music so we could hear Kathy, Dan, and Harry sing it as they just did. By the time that song got set to music, Woody was in the throes of Huntington's chorea, a disease that would take his life as it had his mother's. The incident he describes was indeed a battle plane crash. It took place on January the 28th, 1948. It killed 32 people, including four Americans who comprised a flight crew and a security guard. And what struck Woody was how the news reports of the tragedy named the flight crew and the security guard, but only referred collectively to the 28 passengers as deportees. I've been doing some work and research on the life and times and songs of Woody Guthrie lately, and I found a very interesting backstory to this incident. The 28 Mexicans killed were indeed being deported, but they were not in the country illegally. They were allowed to work in the United States as farm laborers by means of an agreement between the United States and the Mexican governments called the Braceros Program. The American farm contractors who did the hiring under this Braceros Program were responsible for transporting those they had hired back to the Mexican border if they, the contractors that is, no longer wanted or needed their services before the agreed upon length of time for hiring the workers was up. They said you could be here for 6 months. It turned out they only wanted them for four, and they were responsible for sending them back. And this Braceros program, which ran from the early 1940s up until 1964, has similarities to what has much more recently been proposed and seemingly consistently shot down as a guest worker arrangement for Mexican or primarily Mexican farm laborers. How much or how well Woody Guthrie knew of all this himself is not really clear. By 1948, he was living in New York with his second wife, Marjorie, and they were raising their three children, Nora, Arlo, and Jody. But the news reports of the plane crash over Los Gatos Canyons near Fresno, California, took him back some 20 years to when he was working the fields in Southern California in an effort to support his first wife and kids whom he'd had to leave back in Texas after the dust storms there had ruined their homes and their land. And he had worked next to and he had sweated next to the Juans and the Rosalitas and the Jesuses and the Marias. He knew of their humanity, he knew of their struggles. And what he was really trying to say with this poem, and for him it was a poem, which became one of his last well-known songs before his health failed him, was, hey, these people are human beings too. They have names. Many of them have families. They're working so that others of us can eat the food they pick. And to collectively refer to them as simply deportees is to rob them of their humanity, even in death. As politically sophisticated as he was, and however much he managed to try to hide that sophistication, I don't believe Woody Guthrie was primarily out to make a political statement with this song, so much as he was just trying to speak up for the basic human integrity of those who had lost their lives and who were still going unrecognized and unnamed. The radio says they are just deportees. Well, in some ways, it's been a long, long way from 1948 to 2010. In other ways, there's very little distance in the intervening 60-plus years at all. I'm going to pick up on this point a little bit later. For the next few minutes, though, the next several minutes, I'd like to explore how our nation, from its earliest days, has had what amounts to a severe cultural split personality disorder when it comes to our feelings and attitudes towards immigrants and immigration. We became a land of immigrants when the first of Columbus's voyages hit our shores, the ones of the Caribbean, nearly 520 years ago. The fallout from that event, as I've spoken to on other occasions, as it affected the native population in subsequent years, is a very sobering story It's not the one I am telling today. And that split personality disorder, which I just referred, set in sometime thereafter. And what I mean by that term points to what has to be one of the greatest and one of the most maddening paradoxes in our nation's story. On the one hand, we like to pride ourselves, and quite rightly so, in many respects, of being the open door to the world. We hear those wonderful sentiments by George Washington and Woodrow Wilson that Rory read a few minutes ago. And the song we heard earlier, Ezra Lazarus' famous poem on the Statue of Liberty, lifts the lamp to the golden door to our shores, tired, poor, huddled masses yearning for freedom. A lot of truth in those words. A week ago, last Friday night, at one of the events of the Kerouac Festival in Lowell, I was moved to near tears as I listened to a Cambodian poet read his work about escaping the reign of terror of the Khmer Rouge's killing fields and making it to America, knowing that other family members and friends and fellow citizens of his were being slaughtered even as he got out. How could you not love your country after hearing that? But there's also a tragic kind of underside of the image of the lamp, the golden door. It's about what has too often happened to those huddled masses and their descendants once they get here. Consider these words spoken by a very prominent American as the 18th century drew to a close, and as large numbers of German immigrants began to arrive in what was predominantly at that time an Anglo-English culture. Those who come hither are generally of the most ignorant, stupid sort of their nation. Unless the stream of their importation can be turned, they will soon outnumber us, and we will not be able to preserve our language, and even our governments will become precarious. The gentleman goes on to ask, why should Pennsylvania, founded by the English, become a colony of aliens who will shortly be so numerous as to Germanize us instead of our Anglifying them, and who will never adopt our language any more than they can acquire our complexion? Those words were spoken and published by Benjamin Franklin, signer of the Declaration of Independence, one of the authors of our Constitution. He was, by any measure, one of the most brilliant, creative, inventive human beings of his time. But that did not still prevent him from having his cultural blinders. Cut to some 70 years later, following a devastating and deadly potato famine in Ireland in the late 1850s, Irish immigrants came through the Golden Door in large numbers, quite literally fleeing for their lives. And yes, they found refuge here, but in many of our major eastern cities, most notably Boston, they also encountered messages in the windows of certain business establishments and in the help wanted sections of newspapers that said, no Irish need apply. In an 1871 issue of Harper's Weekly magazine, which is the forerunner of our Harper's Monthly periodical today, a cartoon ran showing a drunken Irishman sitting on top of a powder keg barrel he was preparing to light while swinging a bottle of whiskey with his other hand. The title of the cartoon was The Usual Irish Way of Doing Things. The author of the cartoon was Thomas Nass, the same editorial cartoonist who gave us our image of Uncle Sam as a symbol of our country, and who gave us the symbols or images of the donkey and the elephant as the symbols of our two major political parties. Here's where the story gets interesting for me. Thomas Nass was a German-born American. Some of his ancestors may well have been among the targets of Franklin's anti-German sentiments, but that did not stop Mr. Nass from holding up to ridicule and playing to the stereotypes and prejudices of yet another group of immigrants who came to these shores a couple of generations after his ancestors first arrived and who were subject to the same kind of fear and suspicion themselves. This influx of particularly Irish and Italian immigrants in the mid to late 19th and on into the early 20th century also set off a wave of anti-Catholicism, which in what was then a predominantly Christian culture. The suspicions went something like this. They conduct these strange rituals in Latin. The people who are leading them dress up in these odd-looking clothes. They ring bells, they use incense, and they won't even send their children to real American schools. Another of Mr. Nast's cartoons from this era showed American bishops, Catholic bishops, portrayed as crocodiles, swimming up on a shore where American kids were standing, threatening to swallow them up. This, according to Nast, was what would happen if Catholic parochial schools were permitted to exist. Sidebar here, my son went to a Catholic parochial school, Bishop Girton High. He somehow managed to avoid the crocodiles, and he's a member of this congregation. In some cases, yeah, the prejudices with a certain amount of silliness went both ways. In his novel, Visions of Girard, Jack Kerouac writes of how in the Catholic grade school he attended in Lowell in the 1920s, he was told by the nuns that the Protestant kids at the public school up the street had tails growing under their trousers. He adds, which I, for one, actually believed. Much less silly, however, was the questioning of Catholics' loyalty to America. If their primary fidelity was to their religion, and that religion was based in Rome, with its directives coming from the Pope, how could they really be counted upon to be true Americans? I even got a whiff of that myself. I can still remember, as a 15-year-old high school sophomore, St. Albans High School, St. Albans, West Virginia, when then Senator John Kennedy was running for president in the 1960 West Virginia primary. In the Baptist church I attended, there were serious conversations along this line about how, if he were elected president, his first loyalty would be to the Vatican, and he would be taking his orders from the Pope. These were not mean or spiteful or hateful people saying such things. They were good, decent, hardworking folks, persons like my father, who were not even aware of the cultural blinders they were wearing. The fact that Senator Kennedy went on to win that primary and then get elected president represented, among many, many other things, a reversal, perhaps not a complete reversal, but at least enough of a reversal, of nearly 100 years of that type of anti-Catholic fear and suspicion. Throughout our history, then, we have contended with the paradox of the open door, the golden door, the welcoming shore on the one hand, and a kind of tribalistic fear and suspicion of the outsider, of the stranger, of the one we do not know and understand on the other. And our celebration of the golden door, and our exploitation, usually a political exploitation, of the fear of the stranger or the unknown one, that's occurred and continues to occur throughout our history down to this day, and they occur almost simultaneously. I thought of that strong anti-Catholic sentiment that was part of our cultural landscape for so long, and that's not to suggest that it's been completely eradicated. While witnessing the ongoing controversy over the proposed Islamic cultural center to be named the Cordova Center in Lower Manhattan, a few blocks north of where the World Trade Center once stood. I spoke of this a few weeks ago. I'm going to just briefly retouch here. I think New York Mayor Bloomberg, a practitioner of the Jewish faith, made the right call in supporting the building as a symbol of religious freedom and toleration in our country. And I was also struck by the fact that as the opposition came from wide-ranging points on the political spectrum, that another of the senator's supporters was Senator Orrin Hatch of Utah, one of the Senate's most strongly conservative members and a devout Mormon. Perhaps Senator Hatch was recalling the fears of the mistreatment of his Mormon ancestors as he offered his support for this project. Well, personally, first of all, there's not a whole lot in the way of belief or doctrine or practice in either the Catholic or Islamic faith with which I personally connect. But that's hardly a point. I can only offer a few observations. I noticed there's a place within the Pentagon, Washington, D.C.'s own ground zero, for Muslim prayers to be offered. And I've heard no outcry about that. While this proposed facility is not definitively a mosque, there are now two standing mosques within 5 and 10 blocks of New York's ground zero. I hear no outcry about that. Back in December, conservative pundit Laura Ingraham on the Fox News Channel had a very friendly interview with the wife of the center's project director, a woman named Daisy Khan. She said to Ms. Khan at the end of that interview, with respect to the center, "I like what you're doing." That remark seems to have gotten lost in the shuffle. What happened in the meantime? I think in the meantime, it surfaced as a politically exploitable issue. And so my further observation and prediction are these. This proposed center has provided a similar kind of fuel for political exploitation, as did the fear and suspicion of Catholics from an earlier time in our nation's history. I know the wounds of 9/11 still run deep, for all kinds of clearly understandable reasons. They'll be with us, in fact, for as long as there's a country here, I believe. But to stir up a frenzy of opposition to this proposed center is, as I see it, little more than exploitation of those wounds. And my prediction is that once this current election season is over, and once the issue has been milked for all the political advantage that can be gained from it, the center will be built. We'll probably hear very little more about it. If proven wrong, I'll stand corrected, but that's the eventual outcome I'm seeing. Moving on, at the outset of this sermon, I said the distance between 1948 and 2010 was a pretty short one. When it came to what Woody Guthrie was writing about in Deportee. That's the last thread I'm going to pick up for today. I think you could probably take the word German out of that statement of Ben Franklin's, insert the word Mexican, and you'd be listening to a right-wing radio program about now. But this we should acknowledge. We live in a world of nation states with their boundaries and with their stipulations as to who is a citizen or a legal inhabitant of that nation and who isn't. In a perfect world, perhaps, no such boundaries would exist. But that's not the world we live in, however much we may aspire toward it. This is what happens when you get a page out of order here. There it is. Excuse me, sorry. I'll start that again. This we should acknowledge. We live in a world with their boundaries. We live in a world with their boundaries of nation states and with their stipulation as to who is a citizen or a legal inhabitant of that nation and who isn't. As I say, in a perfect world, perhaps, no such boundaries would exist. But that's not the world we live in, however much we may aspire towards it. I'll further acknowledge that, like any other nation, we here have the right and the responsibility to determine who can rightfully be a citizen, who can rightfully live in this country, citizen or not. The issue, though, now, as it always has been, is how do we best go about making that determination? I hold up Woody Guthrie's words here. Is this the best way? Woody was writing specifically about farm labor, but taking just those first 5 words of his takes the question, takes the issue to another level. Is this the best way? Is enacting legislation like that in effect now in the state of Arizona that gives state and local law enforcement the authority to arrest and detain anyone they think might be on the basis of appearance in this country without proper legal sanction? That particular piece of the law has been overturned by a higher court. It's still being appealed. Is the best way, as has been proposed in some quarters, the revocation of the 14th Amendment that grants citizenship to those born within our borders? That effort seems to have run out of steam, but the fact that it was proposed by persons in positions of power that would actually allow them to initiate such an action is something I find rather sobering. Is this the best way? What is the best way? The recent Arizona legislation raised an issue within our Unitarian Universalist family as to whether or not we should hold our 2012 Annual General Assembly in Phoenix as scheduled. What was decided at last summer's GA in Minneapolis, which I did not attend as I had a rather important wedding to officiate, was that our General Assembly in Phoenix 2 years from now would go forward. The program would largely be built around seeking out and advocating for those best ways when it comes to this whole matter of immigration, about how we find the most just and the most moral means of dealing with those who come into this country under a wide range of circumstances and conditions. Like, there's a recognition within our UU family that we're probably not all of one mind on the subject, but how do we come together and seek out those best ways? A study action resolution to that effect was passed. It's called Immigration as a Moral Issue, passed in Minneapolis. It calls upon our congregations to engage on this issue over the next 4 years. There's more to it than I can read here, but it is a strong and thoughtful document. Copies are available on our social justice table. I hope many of you will pick it up, read it over. And you can offer your suggestions either to me or to Marty Storr, who chairs that committee, as to how we in this congregation might most meaningfully and creatively respond to what our association has put before us, how we might most meaningfully and creatively be in that conversation. Well, just a couple of thoughts before I wrap up on what I know is a still very unfinished topic. For the various disagreements I had with our former president, Mr. George W. Bush, I felt in some ways he was on the right track with the national immigration legislation he proposed in 2004. I had my reservations with some of it, but felt that its passage, which did not happen, would have been a step in the right direction. It did call for increased southern border security, and it also contained a guest worker provision similar to that Braceros program I mentioned earlier. And in a bowed reality, it contained as well a rather demanding and strenuous path to citizenship for those who have been in this country for a certain length of time without the required documentation. And when our former president first proposed all this, it had the support of such conservative-leaning senators as Mr. John McCain and the aforementioned Senator Hatch. That support has long since gone by the board, and you'd be hard-pressed right now to find anyone standing for high office, again in this current election season, who would get behind such legislation. So what happened in the last 6 years? It's not that there's been some great increase in undocumented persons coming here. That number's actually gone down a little. As with the Islamic Center, the matter of persons in this country without legal recourse, a concern that has been with us from our earliest days, has once again become a tool for political manipulation. So all I can do, all I think we can do, is hope for and work towards a greater resolve to find that best way, or more accurately, the best ways, when it comes to how we deal with the ever-changing, the ever-evolving, the ever-struggling, sometimes the even painful story of America, knowing that the best way is not the most politically exploitable or the most politically manipulative way. I cannot help but notice, for example, that for all their differences, the positions of former President Bush and our current President, Barack Obama, on immigration reform are actually pretty close. Whether it would stand a chance legislatively or not, it would be a positive symbol, I feel, if these two gentlemen, from quite different places on the political spectrum, could publicly stand behind a nationwide immigration reform proposal. Theirs might not be altogether the best way, but it could point us in the way of a much more productive and a much more positive conversation than is taking place right now. The American story, then, is one of celebrating the lamp at the golden door on the one hand, while still being trapped by the fear of the stranger and the one who we do not know and understand on the other. Whether we will ever transcend This maddening paradox, I cannot accept. It's been more than 200 years, after all, since Ben Franklin said what he said about the German people. We can hope that maybe out of that paradox, out of that tension, something creative and healing will emerge. I can only ask, which side of this paradox can we at least try to be on, and then go from there? Well, we opened up with Woody Guthrie. We're going to finish up with him. He traveled the length and the breadth of this country during some of his most trying times. Times of a horrible depression. A time of a war that took many young lives. He met people living on the edge of survival, but who still believed they could have a piece of this country that was theirs or that they wished to make theirs. Whatever their station in life, whatever their race or ethnicity, wherever they were coming from, Woody Guthrie called them my people. And he declared in a very simple but straightforward way that they and we and all of us can live in a land made for you and me. Words are there in your order of service. Let's sing that together. Thanks for coming back up, guys.